You are not so smart. Neither am I, and neither is David McCraney. He'd be the first to admit just how we are all very self-deluded and how we should accept that. But how we are self-delusional, that we'll get to coming up in just a minute on Coast to Coast. So I've been looking into the which fault lines run through Oklahoma and Kansas. New Madrid does play a role in it, according to some stories that I was researching back to just even a couple of years ago, when there was a discovery of a new fault line that ran through Oklahoma and Kansas, and that they had begun to record these very small earthquakes along these fault lines. In fact, it says here, according to the Oklahoma Geological Survey, from 1977 to 2008, the state of Oklahoma had averaged 56 quakes a year. Usually fewer than five per year, if any, are felt. But that's not true for tonight, and many people were shaken at about 11 p.m. Central Time with an earthquake in Oklahoma and Kansas. What does that mean? I don't know. What's the cause of it? I don't know. Could it have been all of the people that were switching their bank accounts to savings and loans today? Could it be? Was there some sort of seismic shift that happened in the country as a result? Or am I making the kind of connections that always gets me in trouble with David McCraney coming up next on Coast to Coast? This is Ian Punnett. Just for the record, I really do support that idea of moving bank accounts into privately, locally owned savings and loans. I have a couple of accounts. I also have a bank account, but I think it's really important people take a look at where their money goes and what it goes to support. But I am not so smart. David McCraney is here, and I with every page that I turned in your book or with every click on your blog, I am reminded of all of the self-delusional people out there. I may be at the top of the class or bottom of the class, depending on how you look at it. But either way, it's great to have you in conversation tonight, David.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This is going to be really fun.
Good. Well, I know it is. I'm just going to tell you now, I'm going to go to the calls early. So we'll get a lot more in than we ordinarily would. But it's just because I know that you're going to hit so many people's sweet spots along those treasured, you know, holy of holies in their self-perception. And they're going to want to talk about it with you, and I won't be equipped. So let's pick up something we just heard when we were doing a couple of open line calls. Somebody was talking about the 11-11 phenomenon. And I just want to throw this just, I know it's, I'm not saying it's in your book or anything. I don't know if you've ever addressed it in your blog, but a lot of people look at that kind of thing. And they think that when they see that number 11 or 11-11 on a clock, that they're inclined to look up and see it, and that, or significant events happen around the number 11. Where are you with that kind of thinking? Could that possibly be true?
Well, I suppose, many things are in the realm of possibility, but what's weird about paying attention to 11, 11, 11 is that nobody puts the 20 in front of the 11 at the beginning, because that would make it not be as interesting. And that plays into something I write about a lot in the book, and it's just, I mean, it's under the umbrella of just pattern recognition in general.
Right, okay. That's kind of where I thought you'd be going with this pattern. You talk about pattern recognition.
Okay, well, you know, one of the ways that we've been able to escape the state of nature, get out to hack our way out of jungles and savannas and just generally build civilization and culture and technology and iPads and spinning wheels and everything else that we've got, is because we are able to parse out order from chaos. So we are very, very good. The brain is a pattern recognition machine, and so we tend to look for the signal and ignore the noise, but it's an active pursuit. Something I talk about in the book that I think is a good visualization of this, a good metaphor, is the Texas sharpshooter fallacy. So that's imagining that there is imagine, if you will, there is someone who is shooting at the side of a barn with a gun, and they shoot over and over and over again. And then the barn fills up with holes, and then the person walks over to the barn and paints a bullseye around where the holes clustered together. And so now they look like a crack shot. But what they've done is they've painted human meaning, human order over somewhat naturally occurring chaos. And we tend to do that a lot. We look for the hits and we ignore the misses. And that's how everything from con artists to magicians to psychics to many other operators of many people who sort of hijack our pattern recognition system. That's how it operates, because we are always going to look for pattern. We're never going to look at a cloud and just go, look at all those water molecules. They look so lumpy. We're
right.
going to look at the cloud and say, that is a knight riding a teddy bear. It's amazing.
Right. I'm going to push you on that a little bit, because I'm curious about that. First of all, I saw the video on YouTube of the sharpshooter in the barn thing. Somebody sent that to me at before it was announced that you were going to be the guest this week at Coast to Coast. Somebody sent me a link to that, which I thought was kind of an interesting coincidence, pattern recognition. But it speaks something to me to something else, though, and that's that our pattern recognition systems often aren't just a way of trying to define meaning out of chaos, but that's how we survived. Is that, and then this, let's, you know, please address this in the way that you would, but I mean, that's how we discover medicine. That's how we discover, it's a kind of a trial and error. If you eat this berry, then you'll die. And it may take three or four people to eat that berry and die before people go, okay, don't eat that berry. But that's the kind of thing that is different for us. And that the same thing for animals. I mean, I think they learn the same things sometimes with trial and error too. Why is that different?
Well, you know, any thinking creature, you know, or any creature, life forms, we go toward stimulus and we avoid stimulus based off whether or not it's rewarding or damaging or it's painful. And the most successful creatures are the ones that are able to keep some sort of sense of pattern whenever we go back and forth between new situations and compare them to old situations. Conditioning works really well with just about every creature out there, and even amoeba are going to go toward stimulus that they're used to and then avoid ones that they know are damaging. But even though, you know, your cat is going to is easily conditioned, your dog is easily conditioned. The difference is most animals just do what they do, and they're easily conditioned, but most animals don't feel things like shame or pride or regret. Human beings have this metacognition that takes place. We also think about our own thinking, and meaning is something that we apply to not only to, you know, when order comes out of chaos, but we look for agency behind the things around us. There must be some, you know, if we our ancient ancestors, the ones who, when they heard a rustling in the bushes and they said, that could be something that's about to eat me. Those are the ones that went on to have children and, you know, be your ancestors. And the ones that didn't do that sort of thing didn't. So pattern recognition is very important. And recognizing agency behind the things around you is very important. So in the best of situations, these things serve us very well. But we're not always in the best of situations. And we never turn off that pattern recognition software. We never turn off that machine. So if you hear a creak in a house, you will think immediately, maybe there's an agent behind that, because there could be a guy with a knife, or it could be maybe a ghost from the netherworld. Could just be the house settling. But our ancestors erred on the side of caution, and so do we. And the good thing is that we invented something called science, and science is sort of the method we use to outsmart ourselves, to keep ourselves, to get around these stumbling blocks, to look for pattern in the noise, but try to do so by looking for disconfirming evidence as much as we look for confirming evidence. And when we do that and we're checked by other people who are doing the same thing, we can get toward the greater truth instead of just bouncing around the world and making our best guesses.
Well, I love that thought. Again, we're talking with blogger and now regular good old fashioned published author David McRaney. You are not so smart. Let's talk about science a little bit, because I was reminded of a conversation I'd had with a very famous astrophysicist or astronomer, I can't remember what he was, from England, who made the claim, and it somewhat to my frustration, that even when science is wrong, it's right, that the scientific method is never wrong, and that even when science makes bold claims and says, this planet is, you know, is uninhabitable. You know, we have it confirmed. We've done it peer review. Yes, we all agree. Yes. It's uninhabitable. And then, like 6 months later, come on, this planet is completely habitable. And now we've used the, and that they were never wrong. They were it was just the data changed, but science was never wrong. And I find that odd to me that we elevate science to what seems often like the same type of Texas sharpshooter phenomenon of painting bullseyes around holes in the sides of barns. And that's the part that, because I think there are many times science has just been flat out wrong, said this is impossible, it could never happen, right up to the eve of when it happened, and it was proved to be totally possible.
Well, you know, let's remember, first of all, scientists are just human beings, and
right?
Everything I write about in the book, Einstein did it every day, and, you know, Newton did it every day, and whoever is the smartest person alive right now is also doing it every day. So these are just the things that we all carry around with us. But
right.
And the idea behind science is to, let's acknowledge that that's true, and let's remember that science is not a thing that we just put down in a book and that's the truth. Science is an act. Science is a process. It's the method. It's not really, we shouldn't look to science as being an ideology or as a, some sort of, mountain of data that is always going to be sitting there and always going to be the same. Science is a self-correcting process. It has self-correcting mechanisms within it. So, we always have to say that this is what we believe is true based off of the current evidence and all of the evidence that is piled up behind this. This is what, and whenever a scientist comes out with a, and I'm not a scientist, this is just a journalist's opinion on this, but whenever a scientist comes out with, say, a paper, that paper is, it has to address all the science that's come before that has an opinion on what that scientist has just discovered. Here is this tiny, tiny sliver of information that is pushing us one inch closer to whatever the actual truth is. Then every other scientist in the world who's an expert on that subject will jump on top of that person's study and pick it apart and tear it to pieces. And this happens over and over again. So an individual scientist can be wrong. An individual scientist may be going in the wrong direction. But over time, it gets self-corrected, and it gets closer to the truth. That's why it's important for when you see a single study in written about in the media, remember it's just a single study and it's part of a long process, and there will be a long process not only before but after.
Right.
And hopefully, you know, when people criticize science, sometimes they go back and they criticize something from 30, 40, 50, 100 years ago, and you know, you should really be paying attention to what is the current understanding, because it's just trying to figure out the world using a method and paying attention to the data that we have now. And
I'll go along with that. I guess here my point, and I'll reveal my hidden agenda on that, is that
okay.
as a person of faith, it's science that's often used to kind of, you know, give me the sort of fact facial, you know, that sort of says this can't exist. God doesn't exist because we have science. And so just all the things that you said about we're moving closer to the truth, I would say that about theology. Or spiritual experiences or the paranormal. We may not be there, but we're moving closer to the truth all the time, just as is science. And just as science is comprised of scientific humans, so are all other endeavors too. And we're all just humans, just all kind of working it out. And that's, so there are times when sometimes science is held up as this plumb line, you know, this sort of horizon line by which we can measure this is good, this below this is bad. And I think that's convenient when it's allowed to move its own horizon line, but nobody else is. But that's just me. Go ahead. I'm sorry. No.
That's fine. But remember that, you know, science is not a camp that's opposed to all the things you mentioned. It's a method that, theology or the paranormal, it's a method that those things can use as well. And as long as your opinions in whatever it is that your agenda is seeking, as long as those opinions are based off of evidence that are culled from data, then you're okay with science.
No, I'm good with that. I guess to use your point about using 30-year-old data for science, science loves to pull 2,000-year-old statements out of the Bible and go, you see, this is crazy. but again, we're talking with David McCraney. You are not so smart. The overall understanding that we have from your blog and from the book, which is a collection of some of your best work, is that we are self-delusional. And so as just kind of a thesis on that, why do we delude ourselves, and how, why are we not more aware of it while it's happening?
Okay. That's the meat on the bone right there. Let's get to it. You're not so smart. I like to say it's a celebration of self-delusion because, my central theme in both the blog and the book is that we're unaware of how unaware we are, but we don't really feel that unaware. And that's because we're the unreliable narrator in the story of our life. And what do I mean by that? Well, when we look back on all the things we've done, all the things we've thought, if we observe our own behavior, we do that not really knowing what the source or what the originator of that behavior is. A lot of times that stuff is in the unconscious, or it's just it's something we didn't pay attention to in the moment. And so there are two large theories in psychology that I write about most. One is cognitive dissonance, and that's got all the biases and stuff are usually in that. And the other one is self-perception theory. And I like self-perception theory myself. It's more fun to write about. And that is that we observe our own behaviors and actions as if we were someone on the outside, someone who doesn't actually know why we're doing what we're doing. But it's very uncomfortable to believe that. It's very uncomfortable to think that. And so we come up with stories, we come up with narratives to explain our behavior, and those narratives are in psychology are called confabulations. The gulf, you know, between the confidence we have in understanding ourselves and our true understanding is pretty wide, and that's the area I like to explore. You can really mine that area for a lot of interesting stuff, and it's fun to talk about. A good example of confabulation is there's a study where they would give people two tiny postage stamp pictures of faces. And they would say to the subjects, okay, I want you to pick one of these two faces and say, but whichever one you believe is more attractive. And then they would take those faces and those little postage stamp pictures, and they would put them aside, and they'd hand them a big 8x10 photograph and say, okay, this is the face you picked. I would like you to write out an essay now and explain why you picked it. And everyone in the study will write out an essay saying, okay, I thought it was symmetrical, or I thought this person had nice eyebrows, or they had an attractive smile. The trick, of course, in the study is that both pictures were the same picture. And so the person picked them arbitrarily, and then when they were tasked with coming up with an explanation, they did. And we do that all the time. We are always tasked with coming up with an explanation for our behavior. And the story that we tell ourselves about ourselves and to tell others about ourselves isn't always the 100% truth. If you were to think of your life as a movie that you're watching every once in a while when you're looking back on your on yourself, that movie is more something that's based on a true story and a lot less something that's akin to a documentary. And we do this because we are very concerned with keeping up our self-esteem, because self-esteem translates to self-efficacy. And if you want to get out of bed in the morning, if you want to attempt something that's difficult, you want to avoid depression, you have to have a really high opinion of yourself. And many of the things I talk about in the book are the methods and the narratives we use to have a very high opinion of ourselves.
We'll get back to that then. That's just where we'll start coming up in just a minute on Coast to Coast. David McCraney, you are not so smart. Having a high opinion of ourselves as a necessary component to functioning, is that just in our society? Do we need that if we're living on an island somewhere all by ourselves? How many people around us do there need to be for us to fall back into self-delusion? We'll get to that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. We're talking about the brain versus the mind versus ourselves, how we delude ourselves in all these many very interesting ways. You are not so smart. David McCraney's book. It reminds me, though, if we're talking about, you know, brilliant people who sometimes bordered on crazy, The story I think that we're hearing tonight for the first time, and maybe this story's been out, but I just somebody sent me a copy of this story. I think it may be from Radar Online that that Steve Jobs did a series of like sit down interviews or did hours of interviews with PBS back in the early 90s. They used about 10 minutes of it, and they just recently rediscovered it in their vault. And it's going to be the source of a documentary coming up. That's always so interesting when they do that. What a great mind. And in the news of the brain, in that new book that Gabby Giffords has out about her struggle, recovering from having been shot, the book that she wrote with her husband, they talk about some of the things that she was able to remember during her therapy. And they were showing her pictures of people who had been in the news both before and then during and after her being shot, just to see how she was cognitively relating to faces in the news. And she was shown a picture of Arnold Schwarzenegger, who at the time was particularly embroiled in this baby scandal. And her response was just looking at his picture. She just said the first thing she associated with him was messing around babies. And then they asked her about herself, and they said what they showed a picture of herself, and they talked about what did she remember about herself. And she said, shot, shocked, scary. So interesting how the brain works. And we'll pick up that conversation coming up about why we delude ourselves, that without our own self-delusional mechanisms, we wouldn't cope. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. David McCraney is a blogger and an author, two-time winner of the William Randolph Hearst Award for his journalism. So, David, if we were, as you see it, you know, writing about this as long as you have, would we need to delude ourselves if we were sitting by ourselves on a desert island somewhere?
I'm not sure, but I would think so. I would think so. I mean, I know I'm deluding myself sitting around the house all day doing interviews and writing away on the blog and on the.
What are you deluding yourself about?
I think that you have to have a healthy dose of self-delusion to have some sort of self-efficacy, to believe that you can do things, to just jump right in the ocean and then force yourself to sink or swim. And, you know,
why isn't that just pattern recognition, that you've noticed that in the past you're the kind of person, for better or for worse, just maybe the way the molecules lined up in your genetic composition, that you're the kind of person who can jump into the deep end and swim? And maybe other people can't, but you can. And you just notice that from pattern recognition, that somebody could call you up from the Sun Sentinel and say, I'd like to interview you, and you hit the ground running and you can do it. And where's the self-delusion in that?
You're right. It could be, there definitely could be pattern recognition there. I'm not going to deny it. The only reason I have such an opinion on the idea that self-esteem is such an important part of the human condition is that the studies come back over and over again saying that on average, statistically speaking, that people tend to have a very high opinion of themselves, that we see that we people, and when I say people, I usually like to use second person, so you and me and everyone else, but you tend to believe that you are better than average driver. You are a more moral person than the average person. You're a little bit more intelligent than everybody else. You have better taste in music and movies and so on down the line. And that sense of being that there is such a thing as an average person, and that's not you, that the average person believes they aren't average, that helps most human beings get out of bed in the morning and get what they need to get done, and helps us connect with the world around us instead of sinking into a shell, to recoiling from the light. And it's a good thing. I think self-delusion serves us well in the best of circumstances. And the worst thing we could do is to assume that we aren't self-deluded, because when we aren't in the best of circumstances, we should be able to recognize when we're engaging in actions, behaviors, and cognitions that may be counterproductive.
All right. Well, I still want to understand better the line between pattern recognition of something factual and self-delusion. So give me another good example of the ways in which we delude ourselves into whether it's an action or it's a some sort of hobby or activity. I'm trying to find a way to describe it that's beneficial to us or to our family or something that brings about a greater good, but it's self-delusional.
Okay, well, there's this thing called heuristics in psychology, okay? Heuristics are the sort of mental shortcuts. And this is an example of something that serves us well. This is definitely a survival technique that, in the best of circumstances, keeps us rolling, keeps us rocking. When it comes to the brain is always ready to trade inaccuracy for speed. So if you can get to the solution faster than normal, faster than you would if you had never been exposed to the information before, the better off you'll be. So to speed up processing, we tend to think in terms of schemas. So if I say to you something like cowboy, now all of a sudden in your brain, popped in your head, you have a picture of a cowboy. But I could also say to you bottom of the ocean, and boom, pop in your head, you're thinking about the bottom of the ocean, even though you've never been there. And if I say to you, guy with a gun, now the way you look at that person with a gun is going to be based off your heuristical model. And sometimes that serves us well, but in specific circumstances, it could lead to inaccurate descriptions of perpetrators. It could lead to it could lead to prejudice. It can lead to all sorts of weird things because we're deeply invested in getting there quickly, and we'll use things like the affect heuristic and the availability heuristic so that if something makes us, we tend to look at things as being either good or bad first, and then we tend to look into the nuance of the thing much later. The statistical information and the hard data is something that comes way later. And sometimes that first impression will last even through looking at the data. And something with the availability heuristic may be something where you tend to put more emphasis on anecdotal evidence than you do on statistical evidence. So if you, for instance, hear that some people got sick from the flu shot, and maybe some people, a certain number of people die from it. Maybe someone you, on the news, you see someone died from the flu shot. Now you're going to be hesitant to get a flu shot yourself, even though statistically the odds are that it's not going to happen to you. It's very safe. So heuristics speed up processing, and in the best of conditions, they serve us very well. But when it comes to trying to parse out the very complicated, nuanced, and statistically, you know, dense world, they can make us come to really strange conclusions about how the world works.
Okay. And I would say that, just to use your example of the flu shot, I noticed a pattern that whenever I didn't get a flu shot, I had a healthier winter. And so I stopped getting my flu. I stopped taking flu That's like great. 3 years ago. I stopped doing it because I thought, wait, I'm not, every time I get the flu shot, I actually get the flu for a little bit. I'm not saying it caused the flu or whatever, but whenever I didn't get a flu shot, I would actually have a better winter. And other people in my family would get the flu, but somehow I still get the flu.
My book is definitely not about you. You are smart.
No, I'm not. But see, I look at that and I'm trying to think of, is that pattern recognition or am I deluding myself? And I'm trying to understand better because I don't think for a second that I've got everything figured out. For example, I would never say that my taste in music is better than anybody else's or my taste in movies or anything else. But I do think that I do think that there is a plumb line of morality that I think I would say I work hard at never, you know, dipping down to what I think would be kind of an average understanding of morality. Mm-hmm. And I would look at that statistically on the basis of the number of people think it's okay to steal a little bit, or the number of people who think that, you know, that that it's okay to cheat a little bit, or it's okay to, you know what I mean? And I look at that and go, you know, I'm going to try to have a better standard than that. But then I think, well, am I kidding myself? I just, you know, am I filtering out little times when I cheat or little times when I'm or when I'm not being honest, and I'm just not letting those sink in, or I'm just not recognizing those for what they are. And that's what your book challenges me to think about.
Yeah, you know, in the lab, when people who believe themselves to be highly ethical or highly moral people, which tends to be everyone, not, there aren't many people out there who are going to say, yeah, I'm a scoundrel and I love it. But there's a, most people say, I'm ethical, I'm friendly, I'm competent, I'm moral. But whenever you put people in the lab and you give them an opportunity to cheat, it's something that's pretty easy to induce, and it's also easy to diminish. You can prime people with thoughts of morality by having them like read the Ten Commandments before engaging in a self-assessment test where they have a great opportunity to cheat. In a situation like that, people will be disinclined to cheat, but if you don't prime them first, most people do cheat. And, you know, we are always trying to salve over cognitive dissonance by justifying our actions. So if you did end up in a situation, I'm certainly not trying to pick on you.
Go ahead.
Any of us,
no, no.
If any of us were in a situation where the, say, you know, it's one of those things like, would you steal bread to, you know, feed your family? So, in a situation like that, easy to justify, and maybe on paper, maybe objectively, it's wrong by some moral standard. And the lines that we will, the areas that we will push that moral standard into can change depending on how deeply we desire justification for our actions so that we can continue to feel moral or just continue to feel consistent or continue to feel effective. Cognitive dissonance is an awful, awful feeling, and we're always ready to salve over that brain sunburn with some sort of justification, or we might even change our attitude towards something so that we will still feel justified in our actions.
I'm going to push in a slightly different direction here, and I've read many, 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 many chapters of this, but I don't remember you addressing this. So if you did, pardon me. But let's talk about something like the idea that I saw a UFO once. I'm 18 years old, wasn't going to the waterfront to see a UFO, saw a pattern of lights, saw my rational brain kept telling me was a rescue operation. They must be looking for somebody in the water, must be something else, must be searchlights, must be. And then everything went out the window when these three lights went straight up into the night sky, straight up like rockets into the night sky after having been following a pattern along the waterline. And I have no explanation for that. So how do we look at pattern recognition, or how do we look at self-delusion, or how do we look at any of this if we have no previous history with that, if there's nothing on which to judge what we're experiencing?
Well, my philosophy on this, and, you know, this is my philosophy, but I would say that it's okay to say, I don't know. And that is a strange thing that that most people or many people find it hard to accept, especially when it comes to the unknown or when it comes to the mysterious. And believe me, I love the unknown. I love the mysterious. And I grew up on In Search Of and all those great shows, Unsolved Mysteries. And that's I love it. The feeling you get when you when you're exposed to the mysterious is wonderful. But when we construct an argument from that, and I don't mean to be disparaging with this, but
No, please do. Don't make any apologies. You're doing great. I think this is very interesting.
Okay. Thank you. The argument from ignorance is what I call it in the book.
Right.
It's a logical fallacy that's it's pretty common. If you take a logic class or anything like that, it'll come up. It's old. It goes way into the, back into the Latin and the Greek. But the argument from ignorance is just saying, let's be careful not to, if we don't know the source or the meaning or the or why something is, or we don't know what we saw, let's be careful not to assume that it could be anything at all. Let's try to look for evidence to the contrary of our assumptions first and then work our way backwards. A lot of the paranormal, a lot of what goes into the realm of the paranormal sometimes is the result of committing the argument for ignorance fallacy. So if you believe something is true or false because you can't find evidence to the contrary, that's a weird way to go about it, because not one explanation isn't necessarily as good as another. So maybe the lights you saw, maybe that was a spaceship, but it could be many, many other things. So let's, if you want to be totally objective about it, let's say let's lump alien spacecraft into a number of explanations that it could be. And then if we work toward trying to figure out what it is, and if we can't, we just have to say we don't know. And we shouldn't put too much weight on the idea that it was that we have a ready answer for what we saw. We should say it should be better to just settle on I don't know.
Well, your answer is actually very encouraging for me, because that's all I can ever say, because I didn't see inside these, whatever these light things were. I was far away from them, so I don't know what they were made of. I just know that they were lights and that they were doing things which at first looked human and of this earth. And then afterward, I have no earthly explanation for what they did. And I called J. Allen Hynek's UFO Center at the time, and I logged in on the whole bit and tried to find out whether there had been any type of, you know, maneuver or anything that was happening out in the water. And no, there wasn't. And every way that I could find it, but it does go down. It just falls into the category ultimately for me of I don't know, except it is exactly that. It is an unidentified flying object. It was flying. It was some sort of object, and I have no idea what it was. Right. So to me, it is a classic UFO, indisputable case of a UFO. Right. And so that, to me, what's interesting about that is sometimes when science will say, and I say this because I get, you know, email conversations going or Twitter conversations with people in this, and they'll say, I'm a scientist. There is an earthly explanation. We just don't know what it is yet.
Yeah, you know, I would, I can see that for just for the, both the UFO believer and the person who adheres to strict skeptical scientific analysis, there's motivated reasoning for both people.
On either end of the spectrum.
Right, and that's a great thing about talking about self-delusion is we can be equanimical in this case. I can say that the person who wants it to be a UFO, they're going to use confirmation bias, and they're going to be affected by the backfire effect and try to get to that goal at the end, which is saying probably UFO. And then the scientist is going to look for the earthly explanation. Now, in the end, neither person is going to win probably, because they won't be able to find the evidence. Sometimes there will be evidence, and one person is going to win over the other. But in situations where we can't get to the answer, we don't know what the answer is, it's okay to say we don't know, and then, you know, add a caveat there. This is going to be science's caveat that let's look for, you know, you use Occam's razor and say what is more likely, that it was a lights from being reflected in the sky from whatever, or it was a trick of the imagination, or was, if it's in a camera, maybe there's some sort of trick that's going on, some sort of malfunction in the camera, and it's pattern recognition on our part, or are they alien visitors? And that's something that that will be science's caveat to that. But the argument from ignorance has to take into account that it's very difficult to prove. We don't have when we have absence of evidence. So it's okay to admit that we don't know.
Very interesting. Well, so we're talking about that line between self-delusion, why we need it, and the great purpose that it serves. I want to keep picking at that a little bit when we kind of got sidetracked. So I want to get back to that idea, because it's so core to understanding why we are not so smart. In the book, You Are Not So Smart, David McGraney is going to take your calls coming up next hour. So let me just say, probably bottom of the hour, not yet. So 30 minutes from now, we'll open up the phones, we'll give the numbers. You can jump into the conversation. We can find out just how smart you are or not on the way. And if you want to see how smart I'm not, sign up for my Twitter feeds. I love to send messages out during the week, stay in touch with you, and write back to you, too. And you can do that, Deacon Punnett, Deacon Punnett, Twitter. Love to talk to you this week, coast to coast.